This is the principal yoga we know and practice in the West. Patanjali's eight limbs of yoga, being a foundation from which to explore, rather than a finite set of rules, still offer a completely relevant and logical pathway for self-discovery. The pathway isn't necessarily linear, and each element offers insights in recalibrating how we work with meaning and live with joy. Introducing the Hustlepedia. There are a couple of words and concepts I've already used that need to be defined here, as they are variously interpreted and have quite specific meanings in the context of creating a good hustle. Their definitions may be different from how you currently use and understand them. OMG. Let's start with the big one first. So all mentions of creator, source, higher power, faith, divinity, God, or whomever are able to be molded to your particular belief system. I'm the first to acknowledge that I struggled with this for years. Not having come from a family that had any kind of faith, my overwhelming thoughts about the big G God that I saw in Christian traditions was that this concept was totally unrelatable to me. The first rule of the good hustle is there is no one dominant belief system. Whatever your perceptions and faith, they will fit the one ultimate path, yours. Fundamentally, whether the faith you choose has a higher power that's all around you or above you, or you believe that God, Guru, and Self are all one, and divinity is within you, and that we are all intrinsically connected at every level of life, to practice a good hustle, you need to simply have a trust in yourself. You also need a motivation to do your work with the intention of unconditional love and selfless service that is vastly bigger and more compelling than simply bringing home a wage and acquiring more stuff. As far as God goes, you get to choose your own terminology here. My stance on Big G God as a word softened and shifted when I came to understand gods via exposure to Hinduism and interpretations of Buddhism. These traditions see God as something within. It was nothing short of a revelation that divinity and enlightenment was something that I had responsibility for and, more critically, control over, through my actions, but most importantly, through my mind. I'm assuming here that you aren't Richard Dawkins or Friedrich Nietzsche, that you have bought, borrowed, or pirated a copy of The Good Hustle because you already subscribe to the idea that there is more than just each of us, separate and alone, returning to carbon at the end of life. Let's agree then that we all come to the party with a faith of some sort. With that groundwork laid out, you'll have your own way of describing what your faith is and how you experience it. Your version of the divine is the only one that matters for you. It could simply be the feeling you get being in nature, riding a horse, or listening to the sea. It could be how you feel when you sit in meditation and find your breath for that one moment of clarity and stillness. Ultimately, it's the moment you lose yourself as you, the doer, and become you, just being. Indian yoga master BKS Iyengar, in Light on Life, puts in perspective the way we tend to see divinity and spirituality as an acquisition. He sees the very idea of a spiritual path as a misnomer. That moving along a path toward divinity infers that it's outside of us, rather than being something that is, by definition, everywhere, all the time. He suggests instead that if we clean and tidy our houses, body, mind, and spirit, then we might one day notice that divinity has been sitting quietly, waiting for us to notice it all along. The Frozen Theme Song Principle. The second thematic stream throughout The Good Hustle that I want to put some context around is surrender. Surrender in the Western usage is seen as defeat or collapse, rather than a relinquishing of control. In the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali transforms surrender from this sort of last resort emergency response into an essential ongoing practice. But who or what are we surrendering to? How do we do it? And why is it so important? In the yogic canon, surrender is to our higher power, to a union with the divine. Surrender shifts our perspective from the obsession with I, are narrow individual concerns and perspective that cause so much of the mind's distraction and create a sense of separation from who we are and how we connect with everything and everyone. Since surrender focuses not on ego, but on dissolving ourselves into a universal consciousness, it reunites us with our true self. This is a massive concept, the understanding of both our innate truth and self, which is a lifetime's undertaking. By way of shorthand, I'm using it in the context of being closer to an understanding of the essence of who we are, how to make sense of that, and how we can apply it to our daily lives. Surrender is not an intellectual understanding. It is a true physical and mindful relinquishing of all control. If you were to think about it in the way people often describe watershed moments in their lives, they use phrases like hitting rock bottom, when they have no other solution but to turn everything over to whatever higher power they're calling out to. As the wartime saying goes, there are no atheists in the trenches. There's nothing left but faith and hope that someone or something somewhere will intervene. It's the step after overwhelmed when we realize we simply can't do it all. Surrender for many of us comes initially from crisis, or, as author and yogi Ahimsa Sarasvati puts it, most of us need a massive pummeling before we give up on being the doer. Not easy and deeply humbling. A footnote on surrender. If you are wondering about the actual process, it's not so much an action as a practice. You need to surrender over and over to consciously release your tight grip on everything all the time. Entrepreneurs are often guilty of holding onto their ideas with all their might, of feeling they are the sole captain sailing the ship with full responsibility for everything. Nuh-uh. If you really want to let your ideas fly, you need to be collaborative. You need to give it up and ask for support to turn it all over to something, someone, somewhere, and simply trust. The act of surrender is coupled with the act of asking for help, acknowledging that you are gently and graciously allowing others to be part of your journey. This is a deliciously long lifetime process, which forces you right back into the moment, as you can't see the short, medium, and long-term outcomes. You can certainly be clear on what you'd like them to be and put yourself in the way of opportunity, but you also need the secret sauce that flavors all successful entrepreneurs, agility. You need to be available for whatever shows up for you. If it looks like the polar opposite of what you had dialed up in your wish list of life, you need to be ready to greet the situation like a beloved family member and open the door to the experience without clinging to the imaginary future experience you had already created in your mind. As Elsa would say, let it go. Unconditional love. Conditions apply. Okay, we're only at the beginning here, and I don't want you freaking out that you don't know your asana from your divine. Suffice to say, we have our definitions and context for the bigger questions without answers. And you know what the intentions behind the use of these words are. But wait, there is one more. And it's a biggie. Yoga is a devotional business. It asks you to surrender to a love that is universal, an unconditional love. And this is the third definition we need to explore, probably with some caution. Perhaps you don't even have a sense of what unconditional love is. Many of us don't, having been mainly raised in relationships with parents and family in a Western culture, where love is largely transactional. It might have looked something like this scenario. If you behave in the supermarket, you'll be rewarded with love and a chocolate bar. If you scream the aisles down, you'll be scolded, shamed, and have a love withheld. The classic binary of good and bad, love, not love, sugar given or withheld. Of course, the majority of mothers understand the unconditional love equation and what they would instantly and instinctively do to ensure the safety and well-being of their child, as different from the well-worn path to stop the supermarket screaming scenario. But that is not so transparent, well understood, or as regularly articulated as love being a reward as part of an overt exchange. Most kids aren't being raised to know intrinsically that they are complete and perfect as they are in their experience of this life. That all they need to do is go out into the world with curiosity and wonder and trust that their life will be played out as intended as they grow through failure and learning. If that were the message, our systems of education and interactions with each other would be entirely different, and not in a bad way. We would have a world peopled with well-adjusted, loving beings who care deeply for the welfare of their fellow humans. But we don't. We have continents populated by people frantically searching for their passion, desperately seeking to get off the endless cycle of work and material reward without basic happiness and peace, caught in their own private pain, anxiety and isolation, desperate for external love and approval. The Western world is built on transactions and material rewards, so little wonder this is how we model our relationships. Unconditional love is what we aspire to in romantic love, which is what we think unconditional love is or should be. I subscribe to the idea that romantic love, as grand and swoony as it is entirely conditional. We enter relationships with an idea of what we are getting and giving to our partner. All good relationships are a series of mutually negotiated exchanges. Doesn't sound quite as hallmark when described this way, does it? I'm not suggesting that the love in relationships isn't genuine and deep, but I hazard it isn't unconditional, and nor should it be. We all need to have boundaries and standards of behaviour we accept and don't accept in our interpersonal relationships, especially our intimate ones. If we work off the I Will Always Love You, Whitney Houston song sheet, or Dolly Parton's If the Original Is More Your Speed, with the inference that love will be given no matter what happens, things can go kind of pear-shaped. A scenario sadly played out in Whitney's own life and tragic end. Just to reinforce, conditional love isn't bad. It is the reality of human-to-human relationships. The rules of unconditional love are, of course, that there are no rules as the love is unconditional. You simply surrender to your higher power, or God, or guru, or spirit, or self-belief, or whom or whatever you have decided embodies the feeling of embracing the beloved for you. That surrender is in the knowledge that you are going to receive complete and total unconditional love for everything, past, present and future, without judgment or criticism, just pure acceptance. You are loved exactly and explicitly as you are in this moment, no matter what. In return, you accept that everything in your life is a direct result of your surrender and is part of your journey, of your Dharma, and is within that unfolding grace. Everything, even the shameful stuff that you would put in the not-so-good box, is a necessary part of your evolution to enlightenment, or wherever you've set your coordinates to go. In Buddhism, this is your karma ripening. Take a breath. This concept is massive. Acceptance, surrender, unconditional. All notions that ask for a large, actually a total, lack of control. As we all break into a cold sweat, I acknowledge this brutally challenges the Western mindset. We have to give over the reins of our mind controlling us with continual reactive thoughts, and not just give them over, but intellectually relinquish control and trust to the somewhat intangible idea of being in the moment. This is a big leap, the biggest, and we aren't always rewarded in a direct and instantly gratifying way. So we have given up control and have to commit to the long haul, with no surety that what we think the benefits will be are going to appear. There's no roadmap and nothing except faith in the divine to be our GPS. Feel free to exit here. But if you are prepared to consider the opportunities, detangling these ideas from our everyday way of living and recontextualizing them into live in la yogi loka, the proposition begins to make more sense. When we surrender in the yogic sense, we give ourselves fully in the spirit of unconditional love. There aren't reciprocal conditions in that we don't have to give ourselves in love so we can wildly manifest money, houses, and dreamboat partners. We don't give ourselves in love to nice people and not the ones we don't like the look of. When we are all one, we are all one. Even with your ex and your asshole boss. All of the activities of our lives become part of our yoga practice. It can exist in every action and interaction through a conscious dedication to oneness with others and a determination to keep the mind clear and present in the now. This can be a game changer when it comes to mundane everyday chores, as it makes these ordinary acts offerings of unconditional love. This view of unconditional love and its enormity takes a while to infuse, and it will be an ongoing theme of the book. While you are turning it over in your mind, let us return to some ancient wisdoms and the context in which we start the journey to adopting this mindset into our lives and business practices. Bigger Magic. In her excellent book, Big Magic, Elizabeth Gilbert recounts reading a blog post by writer Mark Manson, he of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, that said the secret to finding your purpose in life was to answer the one big question. What is your favourite flavour of shit sandwich? It's a crude analogy for what is an often unspoken truth. Every pursuit in life comes with some unpalatable side effects, no matter how much passion and purpose sauce you've ladled on. Zen Buddhism gives us another version of this. Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. This saying can be interpreted in a number of ways with regard to the cyclical nature of life and death and the continual process of learning. However, I think it also fits into the spirit of the good hustle. When all actions and activities are being done with the intention of love and service to others without seeking personal acknowledgement or reward, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It all has the same intrinsic feeling of love, even the shit sandwich flavoured bits. Not seeking personal benefits as your main priority doesn't mean there won't be benefits. It just won't be a reward that comes like a massive sugar rush to your ego, elevating you with uncontrollable endorphins, only to drop you like a stone in the come down and leave you tired, hungry, and craving for more. The reward isn't external or given to you. The reward is the practice. At first, it will be an uncomfortable practice, as our mindset is geared towards work being personal, business being personal. We are the doers, doing that thing that brings us money to conduct our transactional lives based on consumption, inputs and outputs. It's what brings us fame or personal recognition for our singular, spectacular endeavours. It's hard to imagine making the effort required to achieve anything if some personal, tangible reward isn't the carrot we are pursuing. It's also hard to give up the drama. We may think we aspire to being free of suffering, achieving liberation from our ordinary human unhappiness, released from the yoke of neuroses. But do we really? Suffering, in many cases, writes the narrative of our lives and provides a comfortable refuge from which to disengage our willpower muscles or our self-discipline. Of course, that bad day at work means you need a chocolate for comfort. Reminding yourself it is merely the human condition and getting on with life isn't nearly so sweet. It allows us to continue feeding the hungry ghosts that are our attachments. While it might seem counterintuitive, we are often a little bit, or a lot, in love with misery. If you're thinking, that's crazy talk, then ask yourself, why aren't you already liberated from suffering, happy and free with a spacious mind? The formula's been publicly available for centuries. The answer is, it is hard, requires discipline and dedication, and it is not a quick fix. A cocktail's a quick fix. A block of chocolate is a quick fix. Turning off the alarm and rolling over instead of going to the gym is a quick fix, and all come with a little gratification buzz, which nicely distracts us for a moment. That you are even reading this book, however, infers that you are ready to get off this diet, made up of tiny bites and sips of suffering, and chow down on the high-fiber daily goodness of a practice that will ultimately make you feel better, even if it is a little unpalatable at first. We all have the capacity to concentrate on a single matter at hand when we are engrossed in doing something we love. That is the grit and resilience spoken about in growth mindset. The challenge is preparing your mind to release its love affair with the spectacular allure of sense gratifications. You need to focus on stilling down, on becoming clear, and attaining the discipline needed for focus in a culture of attention-grabbing distractions. This is made harder by the fact that it is achieved through mastering tough and not particularly fascinating exercises, such as observing the breath or sitting meditating with a straight spine. Practicing the ideas contained in the eight limbs of yoga so you can know your mind is real, as the mind is the root from which all of our action and reaction happen. In this context, it's worth taking the time to get intimate with your most powerful tool. Mind over matter. You cannot do yoga. Yoga is your natural state. Sharon Gannon, yogi, activist, and founder of Jiva Mukti Yoga. Knowing your mind is a lifetime process. It's the relinquishing of the belief that the world is happening outside of you, that you are not central to all events and happenings, that you don't somehow control your engagement with the world. There are undoubtedly things that you perceive you don't control. Trivia like the weather, non-trivia like major disasters. What is a fact, however, is that we all control our reaction and our beliefs. I've split up the re from the action to underscore that the way we respond to situations is very much a chain of energy and behavior. What action you witness, you reaction. In other words, you interpret the behavior through your own mind and creative narrative, and your actions follow. You choose this reaction actively, although the habit of choosing it may well be unconscious if you've been reacting in the same way for a long time. You might reaction a situation of drama and conflict by reacting out that drama in response rather than just being an observer. You might action it on a deep cellular level, taking your pain, hurt, or shock internally, and mentally acting out all of the ways you could have or should have behaved and responded. Often in these situations where pain is internalized, you will have created a story about how to react and treat in the same way every situation that reminds you of the preceding events. If each of us is a character in our own reactive narratives, very few of us are exercising the option to choose our own endings. It's a fixed mindset Groundhog Day, and we are stuck in the loop of everything being preordained and done to us. We behave as though our narrative is being written by someone else, and we are in a continual flow of reaction and response. It is little wonder that so many of us are affected by anxiety and hypersensitivity, with our bodies in a perpetual fight or flight mode, waiting for the next page in the story to turn. We just don't realize we are actually holding the pen. So, how to take back our stories and be our own directors in the film of our lives, without also being the perpetual internal armchair critics who give us 0 out of 5? The answer is in choosing to, firstly, make friends with and then collaborate with our minds. A purely discipline-based approach to stopping the lurching wave of emotion in all situations and breathing into an empowered state of surrender. This is a choice that involves learning meditation and mindfulness techniques, being able to identify where you habitually react and stop it. You need to understand your mind and thus your reactions. It's a simple premise, sure, but simple is not always easy. You are performing conditioned responses to situations, ones that you may, as an adult, never have questioned before. Your trigger is being tripped and you are fire first without aim. The power of the mind can be devastating, but it can also be astounding. If you can manage your mind, you can discover who you really are. As you'll see when we get into breaking down the eight limbs of yoga against the stages of your new business or creative project, the mind management piece is ultimately the underpinning of your business management. The two aren't separate or separable. Please, sir, can I have enough? It's interesting that when we talk about the stories that form our way of seeing and being, we infrequently mean positive stories. We almost exclusively build our identities on the ways that we aren't enough, building a wall of failings rather than a pathway of successes. We are quick to catalogue a litany of things about ourselves that we don't love. They hang off us like invisible weights, heavy and restrictive of freely moving, thinking and being. First steps in getting to a place where we can surrender and embrace unconditional love, where we can swim around in that salty buoyancy, is to release the weights. To do this, we have to honestly investigate the roots of our stories, the emotional patterns that sit behind them, then release these as fiction so we can move on to living from fact. In Buddhism, this would be termed moving from the unreal to the real, the unreal being samsara, where we are seduced by attachment to material goods and pleasure. The unreal is our belief that these things bring us happiness and that they are permanent fixtures in our lives. The real is when we have polished the dust off the mirror of our true nature and can see clearly who we really are, and consequently are able to make choices and live our lives from a place of authenticity. I've noticed one of the big impediments for women in getting their dreams up and running is the capacity to not be enough. Women seem particularly good at the amazing binary of simultaneously being excellent and never being good enough. It's one of our key multitasking achievements. I don't think I've ever met an intelligent, strong, beautiful, compassionate, successful woman, a category that covers all women, who, once you scratch the surface, isn't racked with the same deep fears and insecurities that seem to universally plague our gender. I have, however, met many men who believe with every cell of their being that they are truly, deeply, contentedly great. This is not a him, her, Mars, Venus, war of the sexes argument. It is, however, truth speaking regarding the way we as women manage to tease out our every last flaw and fear for the world to critique, where men in most cases are not similarly compelled to be so constantly self-excoriating. This has significant impacts when it comes to pursuing your business ideas. You need to be able to muster unshakable belief when it comes to dealing with the many hurdles that will appear at the most inconvenient times. Insecurity needs to meet bravery and self-belief in the middle and modify your reactions. Managing your mind makes managing your decisions much simpler. Meditation and yoga can transform your mind. By adopting a yogic lifestyle, the dust begins to be cleared from yourself, but it is also a confronting process where long-held and buried parts have to reveal themselves to be processed and integrated. Therapy exists for this reason, and I totally subscribe to utilizing professionals when needed to move the healing along when you feel stuck or unable to work the next bit out. Surrender was the key for me. I'd already invested plenty of time and money across the years into trying to offload the feeling I wasn't where I was meant to be or living my purpose. And I knew it was within me, not within my circumstance, that these negative and critical feelings and voices arose. It was clear I couldn't figure it out by myself. And so I literally surrendered to a variety of teachings, teachers, and experiences to reveal the answers to me in their own perfect time. Excavating the unreal to make way for the real is not a trivial exercise. Most of the patterns that have clouded the mirror of self begin in childhood, and by the time we have the vision to recognize them as actual impediments, they are well entrenched. The process of addressing the emotional patterns that have developed from childhood is very personal, and you have to work out what best suits your style of emotional and psychological investigation. My patterns were so common. I simply believed I wasn't enough, and so nothing I ever did was okay. As well as not being enough, I was really afraid. I was afraid of what people thought of me, of people not liking me, of making the wrong decision, of failing, being criticized, and ultimately abandoned by my tribe. Fear itself. Fear drove all my decision-making and reactions. It was so intrinsic, I didn't realize that it was there in the driving seat, and I was somewhere in the boot of the car with duct tape over my mouth and cable ties around my wrists. My fear was completely out of proportion to the actual reality of my life. I was creating a cellular war zone and had been doing so since I was a child. No wonder things were getting so out of control in my mind and body with the accumulation of those four-lane fear highways I had built in my neural pathways. When you're coming from a place of fear, it is nigh on impossible to experience love and grace, to be agile and curious. The field of vision is so close to you that you are barely able to look up from your flight or fight path to see what is going on around you. When you do, everything is viewed through that lens of asking when the next crisis is coming and how you can combat it. It's an incredibly small radius to try to manufacture the capacity to love expansively and magnanimously. How do you feel connected to the world and all the people in it when you are hunkered down in a bomb shelter of flesh and bones? My story is by no means unique. Early parental death pulled the rug from under me, and it took me a long time to regain my balance in trusting that what I loved and doted on wouldn't be taken away. In the pantheon of childhoods that set you up for this type of fear-based mindset, mine was nowhere near the razor wire in the spectrum of trauma some children experience. Without comparison to the unique experience of others, however, the commonness of my story is that many, many of us are living in these fear bubbles, getting along in the world to a greater or lesser degree, but completely restrained from our greatness by our not enoughness. We are unable to see and grasp our potential and, more critically, unable to hear and access our true nature of selves. So everything that we do is based on a false perception of who we are and our capabilities. And consequently, we do what we think we should, not what we are destined to, in the hope of pleasing and being loved. The real love that is missing is, sadly, the love of ourselves. The most terrifying thing about living a life based on fear is that we are simply existing for the external view and action of others. Fear-based existence is easy to get away with in a society where, collectively, this is our version of living. In our separateness and fear, we aren't alone. The stories that we tell each other in the 24-hour news cycle, gossip cycle, and social media cycle completely reinforce the rule of fear. It's like the new hero's journey is based on being born, being afraid, getting stuck, struggling, and suffering, prolonging life while fearing death, and ultimately dying. It's finite, fixed, and to a degree elite. You can have a higher quality of fear and suffering based on wealth and status, as you have so much more to lose. Fear robs us of being in the present. We are living in our minds, in an unknown place and time, fighting battles that haven't started, with adversaries who don't exist. 2020 faith. So how does fear link to starting your good hustle? To surrender to unconditional love, to let go of our attachments and cravings, and live from that vulnerable space of openness, there has to be trust. Complete trust. The kind of trust that allows you to be blindfolded and led by the hand, knowing you won't come to any harm. Perhaps this is the root of the expression blind faith. You have to see and experience your own divinity within all of the reality of your perceived flaws and failings, and in doing so, you also have to see everyone else's. Buddhist nun Tenzin Palmo believes that faith is an expression of courage, not a kind of blindness or belief in something just because you're credulous. In handing over control, you accept a trip without any kind of clear destination, but it is a journey full of the daily pleasure of living without fear. Exchanging self for others is not a situation where one is lost or traded for the other, leaving a deficit. Adopting the service of others in the mode of goodness gives us inner courage, with which we can bravely step into the most difficult of situations. It is unsurprising that Tenzin Palmo holds that belief. She has an extraordinary story. At a young age, in the early 1960s, she was called to find a faith. She eventually dedicated herself to Buddhism and finding enlightenment, setting off from England to India on a freight ship to meet her Lama. As part of her practice, she entered a remote cave in the high Himalayas and stayed there in meditation for 12 years. On her return to the world, she began spreading the Dharma through her teaching and writing, and champions tirelessly for funding the nunnery she has built in India. In interviews, it is often suggested to Tenzin that being in the cave was easier than trying to practice mind management in the chaos and stress of the West. She utterly refutes that and points out that in a cave there are no distractions from the self. The removal of distractions, pleasure and noise means facing the experience of our minds and selves directly. This opens us to the possibility of recognizing that whatever we experience, love, loneliness, hate, jealousy, joy, greed, is in essence an expression of the fundamentally unlimited potential of our awakened nature. When we have this awareness, there are no more surprises within to react to. It is not an easy awakening. This concept doesn't imply there's nothing to fear. Instead, it entreats you to change your relationship to reaction through control of the mind. In your process of surrender, you're accepting that what happens next, or what happens now, is exactly what is meant to happen, and it is how you interpret it and react that determines the experience you have of it. The limiting ideas we hold about ourselves, others, and every other experience can be unlearned. In that moment, suffering ends. There is nothing to fear, nothing to resist. Not even death can trouble you. The Dalai Lama describes Westerners' lives as simply lurching away from any kind of pain or suffering and compulsively leaning into pleasure. This is the reality of reaction, that we are ruled by sense experiences and our likes and dislikes, as though each experience is going to be a lasting and permanent state. We don't have the mental discipline to stay in the center and note the feeling without drama, accepting that this is what is now, not what will always be. This concept works in lockstep with your karma and dharma, presupposing that you are viewing this life as a carryover from the last, on the long middle road to liberation and enlightenment. Part 2. Desperately Seeking Dharma. Find out who you are and do it on purpose. Dolly Parton, singer, songwriter, actor, businesswoman, living legend. When you pinpoint happiness arising, ask yourself what is happening in this moment when you find you are loving what you are doing. This is the point on the chart where you drop a pin, a definite clue to your own happy map. What the Dharma? You may wonder why Dharma is so important in our discussions of getting your good hustle in order. Dharma, depending on your school of thought or religious lineage, can mean different things. In yoga, your Dharma is what is right for you. It is the expression of your true self. So when you live your Dharma, things flow and you feel right in your own skin. The Hindu connotation is that your Dharma is the right way to live. It's personal, inasmuch as only you are able to determine what your Dharma is and, like a fingerprint, it's different for everyone. Some of us are born with a very clear sense of what we're here to do. I can only speculate on why that is, and regardless, knowing it and living it don't always correlate. As discussed earlier, discovering your Dharma can be a torturous process. It was for me, and I'm grateful in a Schadenfreude kind of way that I share this torture with many millions of others. What does seem to be universal is that no matter how we try to navigate around it or avoid it, we end up where we are meant to be, doing what we are meant to be doing. This is our Dharma, and thus our right way to live. In being the right way to live, this notion is directly connected in Hinduism and Buddhism with karma. Karma is simply translated as cause and effect. It's constant and perpetual, and thus works in lockstep with your Dharma. As it is in the interest of minimizing the action and negative reaction that you live mindfully in the right way. Living the right way means accumulating as little negative karma as possible by living within the precepts of a yogic lifestyle. Karma in the West is often interpreted as a dramatic and instant retribution, like a bolt of lightning out of the blue striking down the errant offender. The Buddha says that karma is intention, that what we sow through our actions is not in fact measured by the doing of the action, but by the intention that sits behind it. Accidentally pocketing someone's pen and discovering it when you get home isn't an act of theft, for example. Coveting the pen and strategically slipping it into your bag while the owner isn't looking, while feeling smug at your deception, that is theft. The intention is clearly different, as are the karmic outcomes. Far from being dramatic and showy, karma, rightly understood, is about our own responsibility for the transaction of action and intent from our minds. We are always making a choice in every micro action. And this is why control over the mind and a grasp on awareness is so critical to remaining in a place of loving kindness towards everything and everyone. Unlike karma, there is in reality no simple English translation of dharma. And in the Buddhist traditions, it means a subtly different thing. The Buddha taught a method of dharma or dharma practice rather than a religion. The dharma in Buddhism, or Buddha Dharma, is not something to believe in, but something to do. The Buddha challenged people to understand the nature of anguish, suffering, let go of its origins, release its cessation, and bring into being a way of life that had at its heart the best interest of all sentient beings. The Dharma is a method to be investigated and tried out. It starts by facing up to the universality of suffering, then proceeds to apply a set of practices to understand the human dilemma and work towards a resolution. Stay tuned for a deeper discussion of these ideas in the following chapters. In a world where we are so influenced by the opinions and actions of others and forensically study the minutiae of our lives through social media, our own Dharma path is difficult to discern. When we live in a state of comparison and judgment, under the perpetual threat of criticism and social shaming, we end up parroting the behaviour of others, hoping that it will serve us and keep us under the radar. We do as we are told, or as we think we should, and hope that through this strategy, happiness will appear. What we get from this is suffering, and endless layers of false perceptions to reverse, as we sink more deeply into the mire of sense attachments. In the process, getting further and further away from any possibility of resting comfortably in our own divinity. The purpose of Dharma is not only to attain a union of the consciousness with the divine. It also suggests a code of conduct that is intended to secure worldly joys and supreme happiness. Adherence to this yogic way of thinking understands the attainment of the highest ideal and eternal bliss happens here and now on earth, and not somewhere in a place of separateness at death. Escaping fear, embracing unconditional love, surrendering to divinity, and releasing yourself from the endless stories that define and narrate your experience are the goals of mind management, to get you to a place where you clearly know what your heart desires. But it is a practice. I've said it once and it will be oft repeated. Awareness of patterns and reactions doesn't simply make them disappear. As the meme tells us, one does not simply stop being enslaved to one's suffering. Suffering is, the Buddha would argue, what makes us human. It's not so much a negative thing as a thing, and our engagement with suffering and its myriad causes is a definition of humanness. Suffering is part of the pathway to surrender, when we don't try to stop it, but simply recognize it is going to be a feature of our existence. We take from it the power to throw us into the whirlpool of our minds. Dharma Chameleon. Getting down to your good hustle, the clearing of patterns, the neutralizing of fear, the revelation of what our individual right way to live might be, gives clarity to our purpose. So to begin the process of how this can connect with what we want to do, let's play a new version of that well-worn game. What would you do if money was no object? There is a flaw in that premise, so often used to help people get to the heart of what motivates them, as it assumes that money and the acquisition of money is the meta motivator. A better way of framing the question is what makes you feel love? No need to link it to financial gains or fancy career titles. as all of that is irrelevant if your work is a good hustle that comes from a place of love and devotion. Many books and workshops on how to make a life you love, grow the business of your dreams, and all the other marketing spin need you to know where you want to go to get where you're going. But sometimes that isn't a reality. We simply don't know. We have to feel our way around in the dark a bit. The key word is that we feel, and we develop those powers of intuition and our own internal compass to lead us to the twinkling lights of our magnificent Dharma. If I was to base this investigation on my own list of diverse childhood career aspirations, the common thread was that they were jobs that were of personal service to others in one way or another. The drive in me, even at a really young age, was to touch people's lives and offer some kind of loving support. Literally, in the case of my prostitution aspirations. Writing also featured in what I wanted to do and has continued to be an integral part of my life, work, study and growth. But writing isn't my Dharma. It is an instrument of my Dharma, which is actually teaching. Writing is a super form of expression, but in and of itself is a solo and removed activity, just me and my laptop, and not a sentient being in sight. The discovery of my Dharma was the feeling I got when I saw people connect with their own purpose. It was in my entrepreneurship teaching and business development consultancy work. I was lit up inside by sharing with clients the moment that the dream they had kept away from the light, fearful of failure or defeated by their perceived limitations, could be a reality. When I help people through teaching them about how to merge sustainable business models with their own spiritual path, it gives me a particular feeling where I connect to a joy that is vast and contagious. Teaching for me isn't about having the knowledge or even being the teacher. I don't have any sense of ownership. I see myself as an usher. I shine my torch on information that is unseen in the darkness. Different people need to see different things. I show them how to switch their own light on and then move on to the next project. The building, operating and executing is all down to the individual. This is a factor that I need to keep reminding myself of. Far more evolved people than I have been sucked into the belief that they have a special gift only they can deliver. So not growth mindset. You know what they say, don't believe the hype. When you work in service or to be of benefit, the other person always comes first. Mind your own business. Everything begins in the mind, as only our perceptions define what is happening around us. You begin in the mind. Business begins in the mind. Mind, in the yogic understanding, is both physical and subtle, and covers the entire body from the brain and nervous systems, spanning out to all of our sense organs, and our gross body, which it controls and drives like a supercomputer. So much of the work of new business concepts happens in the mind before a Gantt chart is constructed, a Facebook page initiated, or a dollar raised. Yet so little attention seems to be given to strengthening and managing the mind in discussions of entrepreneurship and ideation. To rock a good hustle, however, the mind is the first port of call in establishing the right attitude and capability to step out of our striving and non-thriving into our business or creative practice. It's never too soon to work on stilling the churning waters of the mind and prepare a calm work surface. We don't need any new tools. We can start with what we have right now. By understanding our mind, everything is transformed. And like charity, transformation begins at home and must be started by you. Ultimately, surrendering what we cannot control allows the ego to relax and lose the anxiety of its own infinitesimally small self in the expanse of interconnection with others. It's timely here to investigate the ego and what it really means. So often we use a concept or have a superficial understanding of what something means through the collective use of a term. The ego is one such term and is bandied about in a way that infers it is some kind of dark controller of your personality over which you have no personal agency. We can't, contrary to popular belief, just let go of the ego. That's like letting go of an arm. It is part of us and a necessary part. From the Western psychological perspective, the ego is akin to a physical entity and represents the personality, the I of a person, the beliefs underpinning what and who we are. The ego is difficult to see because it hides behind opinions that appear true, our attachment to descriptions of our identity, and because we haven't practiced looking. One of the most deceptive aspects of the ego is that it generates powerful emotional reactions and then blames us for how it made us feel, all of which leaves us at the mercy of the ego and removes our own capacity to manage our emotional states and swings. This is where the management of the mind is so critical, as nothing really exists outside of us, and therefore all states are within and in our control. Sure, there is no denying that there are external events and triggers that act as catalysts for us to make a choice on how we react. A mind that is regularly interrogated through meditation and mindfulness takes on the events perceived as good and those perceived as bad with equal curiosity. To investigate the totality of your being, the negative and positive are equal partners in how we perceive ourselves. Of course, too often with a strong emphasis on the negative. Instead, see the ego as your agitated, uncontrolled mind, apportioning blame and playing the victim. By using meditation and turning within, observing your mental state without attaching emotion to it, all situations are understandable and can be released with a loose grip rather than dwelled upon. In this way, the ego is assimilated as part of us and becomes a collaborator and communicator of our inner state, a tool for awareness rather than a despotic ruler. So what can the ego communicate to us? The reaction of emotion is one of the most obvious ways that we know our mind is in sway and ego is acting out. It is this swing of the pendulum that is a giant distraction from being present. Working in mindfulness in cahoots with the ego when an emotion arises, rather than in reaction, allows us to see that emotion from the standpoint of a loving, compassionate observer. The key here is observing its arising and its origins. What situation was the precursor? When it is revealed what our reactive patterns are, this is the area we can focus on to start digging, removing the shadows, and in time clearing out the rubbish from our mind and our heart. A metaphor for this work is that of hard, exhausting physical labor, the excavation and patience required by prospecting, where it can take hours to only scratch the surface of ground buried by years of build-up. And patience is a vital attribute in mastery of the mind. Nothing is achieved in a rush. Patience, paired with disciplined practice, brings with it the required willpower to stay in it for the long game. Got grit? When you adopt the practice of the yogi, you know how short a lifetime is and how many are potentially required to get stuff done. In time, there's no willpower required. You want to do it all the time, as without the practice, life is empty. Of course, this is also exactly the new groove that we want in your neural neighborhood for the work required to create your business. Our goal in the preparatory phase is then to be content to work consistently towards our own authenticity, that moment of clarity when we feel on the path to Dharma. Nothing is everything. Everything is nothing. Along with the Yoga Sutras, the teachings that underpin the massively broad church that is Buddhism, have some concepts that are a very useful contribution to training our minds and preparing ourselves for approaching business from the perspective of it being a good hustle. Buddhist teachings essentially tell us that suffering exists and that ending suffering for all sentient beings is of primary importance. Buddhism also teaches impermanence and that nothing has an intrinsic existence of its own, including ourselves and our identities. Everything comes into being because of causes and conditions, so things only exist because of their interdependence on other things. Buddhists see these interdependencies as part of the fundamental existence of everything, and by taking on these ideas, it is very hard to feel separate, isolated, or alone. You can take a look at anything and break it down to its causes and conditions. Confused? Let's clarify with an example. Imagine a cake. We think of a cake as a solid thing that exists. You've eaten a cake. Minnie. You know that a cake is real and three-dimensional, and yet a cake does not exist as an intrinsic thing. It only exists as the culmination of all the things that make it a cake. Eggs, flour, sugar, fats, air, heat, a greased tin, and its other ingredients. A cake isn't independently existent. It's made of components. And so is everything else. You can deconstruct anything and come to the same conclusion. Things only come into being as a result of their causes and conditions. And the causes and conditions have their own causes and conditions. And this goes on and on and on. The Twitter version of this is that everything is interconnected and nothing exists, including us humans, without the dependencies that arise from causes and conditions. It is an epic, mind-bending consideration, but one that, when firmly entrenched in the brain, is strangely freeing and comforting. Everything about us is in constant change, from the trillions of cells that make up our body to the multitude of processes that create thoughts, emotions, reactions, opinions, and beliefs. We are not us. We are a collective of cells, atoms, water, calcium, however you want to break us down biologically. We are not static objects. We are works in progress, with mind-boggling, complex processes happening 24/7 that all depend on each other. Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, author, and peace activist, calls this state into being. This term embraces a sense of compassion and love that comes from connection. Because all things are interdependent and in a constant state of change, all things must also be impermanent. When we adopt the view that everything is impermanent, we are released, in theory at least, from attachment and, in this school of thought, from the suffering that comes with striving to hold on to something that is not going to be around forever, or the sorrow that comes with loss. If we behave in the mode of impermanence, it pushes us to be in the moment, to appreciate what we have in the now. It forces us to accept the peace that comes with knowing that if everything is constantly changing, there will never be a void when something leaves. Cause and condition will always instantly find a set of elements to replace it with. The problem is that we know this, and yet we continue to cling to things as if they were permanent, because we want these things to last, at least during our lifetime. That doesn't mean it's easy when we lose something or someone that is precious. It just means that the recovery from suffering is able to be understood at a heart and mind level when we learn to see things as they really are, impermanent. The two eyes. Impermanence and interdependence in business is a good thing. Here's how and why. Part of the difficulty for many people in starting up a new business or bringing their ideas to market is that there is a fixed idea of what they are providing, the pathway that will get them there, and the customer whose problem they are solving with their, and by their I mean your, genius. None of this is wrong, and traditional approaches to business planning focus strongly on having these elements and answers in place prior to market entry. You are meant to have risk-managed all of the potential problems you can think of, troubleshoot like an Olympic marksman, and largely eliminated any obstacle likely to get in your path. This is all well and good if you are in possession of the entire spectrum of causes and conditions, which of course none of us are. Once we hit the market and unanticipated things start coming at us right and left, we default to that next setting on the entrepreneur dial, flowing around problems. We are still trying to fix the issue to get to the original destination. When we flow around something, we still head in approximately the same direction with a mildly altered route. When seeing your emerging business from the viewpoint of the two eyes, interdependence and impermanence, you can be radically agile with no suffering. You can accept when things need to do a 180-degree turnaround and not have a moment of clinging to the idea of what might have been. Your only relationship is to what is, and the causes and conditions that constitute your market entry in the moment. In the early stages of coming up with an idea for a new business, project, or venture, the process of refining your idea is a straightforward formula. You see a gap in the market, a problem to be solved, and you have an elegant solution to that problem that meets the market at a point where the cost of solving the problem is acceptable to the customer and delivers surplus revenue. While this follows a relatively linear path, it is always iterative. The place you start is rarely where you finish, especially if you are using lean startup practices with a minimum